We have a Q&A session afterwards, so we want to proceed as promptly and efficiently as we can, counsel.
Yes, sir.
The next case this morning is United States versus Murphy, and that is case number 185052. Mr. Ridenour, we're ready to hear from you.
Thank you, sir. Yes. May it please the court and counsel. I'm Robert Ridenour. I'm here from the Northern District of Oklahoma in Tulsa on behalf of Mr. Marco Murphy. The issue posited by the appellant, Mr. Murphy, in this case is whether the district court erred by denying him the right of confrontation by allowing hearsay in a hearing before Judge Frizzell in Tulsa. Now, Marco Murphy had served time in prison, and he had been released subsequent to that on supervised release, which is a form of probation that federal inmates serve after their release. And while Mr. Murphy was on supervised release, it was alleged that he had taken part in some drug dealing, and that was grounds enough for the probation office and for the government to decide to bring Mr. Murphy before the district court for a revocation hearing. At that revocation hearing, they brought an officer. His name was Officer Leatherman.
It was broader than drug dealing, wasn't it?
That was the gist of it, Judge.
Doesn't it matter?
Well, actually, sir, when I think...
Are you holding yourself to there having been a drug deal, or is it enough that he was using drugs?
Well, the using drugs was not really what the judge relied upon when it came to revocation. I can't recall whether using was necessarily part of the petition, actually, but I do know that the main reason that Judge Frizzell ultimately revoked him was the allegations about the drug dealing, the true sales. And so at the hearing, the government brought Officer Leatherman, and Officer Leatherman recounted for Judge Frizzell how there had been a confidential informant who had approached police and said that he believed that my client was engaged in drug sales. And so,
but this is at the probation hearing.
Yes, sir. This is the revocation hearing.
So hearsay would be properly admissible for those purposes.
Judge, yes. Unlike trial, where the full panoply of constitutional rights are available to a defendant, it's a to-the-court sort of hearing. And in a court sort of hearing in this regard, there are still the rights for confrontation, still the rights that we expect, you know, in normal due process. However,
we would also expect that the lawyer properly representing the client would ask for him or assert him or object or do something other than stand there like a potted plant.
Not to let the cat out of the bag, but I am the trial lawyer who you are speaking of.
Oops, you're the potted plant?
I was the potted plant, but I think it might have been a little bit better than that in person. But
this is the reason, I mean, for students to note, that a lot of times it's better for appellate counsel to argue the case that wasn't the lawyer below.
I think that the budding lawyers here should always understand that ultimately they're going to be standing in front of appellate court. So when they're at trial level, they better know to make their objection. So they brought Officer Leatherman.
So in any event, you didn't object. You didn't say, hey, this is hearsay.
Ow.
Judge, please don't listen to hearsay.
Here's what I did.
Okay.
They brought Officer Leatherman, and Officer Leatherman at first says to, is asked by the prosecutor, asked, did the confidential informant identify Mr. Marco Murphy as the person who would be selling drugs? Now, I did object to hearsay at that point.
All right.
The court ruled, said, no, that's not for the truth of the matter asserted. Rather, it's just to show what the officer did next. I'll acknowledge, guys, that this was the last time I uttered objection hearsay in that perspective. Now, what did happen, and the government will argue to the court, well, based upon that, then Mr. Ridenour has given up his right to stand before this court and say to the court that this district judge created this error and caused this error. Well, we have argued that there might be a way that the court actually saved us by virtue of at the end of the hearing, or actually at the sentencing hearing, Judge Frizzell chose to make some findings. Like we had talked about, the full range of rights aren't available at a revocation hearing. However, according to Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure number 32.1, a person who is the subject of a hearing in this regard may confront or may assert, let's see, what's it say, that one has the right to question any adverse witness unless the court determines in the interest of justice not to allow that person. So while I didn't talk about hearsay again, I did raise during the course of the hearing 32.1, which was actually as to an ancillary issue of evidence. However,
counsel, can I just stop there?
Yes.
I'm looking at that part of the transcript, and you did mention the rule.
Yes.
And it had to do with, if I've got it correctly, statements made in the jail recordings?
There was a jail phone call from my client to his girlfriend in which the officer Leatherman had obtained the recordings of it, and during the course of the revocation, in support of his indicia that my client had engaged in these drug dealings, that my client had made statements. And so I had objected at that point and said, that's not best evidence.
Right.
I have the right to at least have that so I can confront it. And the judge said, you know, you're right. And then he ended up continuing or allowing the hearing to continue until ultimately he did decide that enough evidence had been adduced by a preponderance of the evidence to revoke my client.
Okay, but you started out with best evidence, but at some point you landed on Rule 32.
Yes, I did. And the Jones case.
And the Jones case,
yes.
And that's in the transcript. But to the extent that you were raising those things as an objection, it was in connection with the jail recordings.
Yes, and I acknowledge that.
And so I guess, I mean, I know that the judge later at sentencing, and I think this is where I interrupted you, but the judge later at the sentencing addresses the balancing test.
Yes, sir.
Under Jones. But what I'm having a hard time understanding is how in your brief now the judge applied that test to all of the hearsay that was presented at the hearing.
Judge, the way that it played out is that, like I said, that we had the revocation hearing. Judge says, I'm going to revoke you. Then we show up for sentencing. And while I had addressed those issues somewhat, Judge Frizzell at the hearing chose to make the analysis that's contained in Jones as to the balancing of interests, whether the government has a sufficient interest not to bring the witness versus my client's right to confront the witness. And Judge Frizzell did, in fact, go over those issues, decided that he balanced it in favor of the government's right not to reveal the name or the identity of the confidential informant, ultimately then said that he had correctly balanced the interest. Now, here's what I have to say. The government says that by virtue of some cross-examination that I engaged in of the officer, that I have waived or given up a known right of the ability to now stand before you and say, hey, I was denied my right to confrontation.
Well, counsel,
yes.
I know that argument's been made, and you devote pretty much your reply brief to that, this Lopez Medina case.
Hernandez, yes, sir.
But even, you know, apart from the cross-examination, what if that isn't going to pose any problem to you, why wouldn't the fact that you, at least at the revocation hearing, didn't object to the full scope of the hearsay evidence that was presented there, just the jail recordings, to the extent that the rule is, Rule 32.1 is sort of a hearsay rule.
Yes.
Why aren't we reviewing the hearsay objection at this point for plain error? And I'm talking about all the stuff you didn't object to.
Yes.
The witness talked about a lot of things without any objection.
There was a number of things that came out about what the confidential informant had said on direct examination. There were a number of things that came out about an alleged trap house where my client had been going back and forth to. Now, what it amounted to me on the ground that day was that I had originally asked the judge, whenever it was asked that my client, or asked if the officer, if the confidential informant had identified my client, I then objected to the hearsay at that point. Because that's the crux, that's kind of the key. Did this confidential informant know my client reliably enough that he could be held, that we could rely upon his information? So, afterwards, then the government did present all this evidence. Here's what the confidential informant said. Here's where this happened. Here's what we saw.
This argument,
yes,
still goes to issue one, whether you're entitled to bring this appeal.
Yes.
Let's say we spot you that. Let's get past the procedural aspect of it.
Yes.
Unless you were finished with your previous answer.
Well, I think I know you were going with that. At some point, we may get back to the cross-examination. But
yes, sir.
All right. Then, assuming, or as Judge Gorsuch on our court used to say, before he was elevated to the nether regions, he said, let's spot you that. So we'll spot you issue one. Let's get to issue two. Did the district court abuse its discretion
in revoking the supervised release after concluding that the interests of justice did not require the testimony of a confidential informant or additional police officers under 32.1.
Well, what I would say, Judge, is first the abuse of discretion standard applies to whether, given the evidence that the court had, did he make the right decision to order revocation under a preponderance of the evidence. Mm-hmm. What I'd like to argue to the court is that by virtue of him not requiring the government to bring this confidential informant and allowing me the opportunity to cross-examine that person, that we put it into a different burden or standard of decision, yeah. Which is whether this court, if you find this constitutional error, then we get to tell the court, okay, you, government, then has to prove that this was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Okay, and so that requires me then to show why the judge, were I to be right in standing in front of you and claiming that I have the procedural right to make these arguments, that would then allow me to say to you that the court did in fact error, because in addition to this information that was allowed, in addition to what the government has argued, I argued that there are certain procedures that confidential informants are used with the police. They are typically wired up with a mic so that the police can hear what's going on. Many times they're provided with a vehicle that has a video camera which can record the transaction between the confidential informant and the alleged suspect. There is also mechanism by which they are searched beforehand, that a certain amount of money is provided to them. But more importantly, yeah, in this...
It wasn't done that well. I think everyone would concede that.
And that's the reliability.
Here's my question I need a precise answer on. What particular hearsay statement are you upset about? That the CI said that he had bought the cocaine from your client?
That he identified my guy as the guy who was selling the drugs. That was
to him?
To him, yes, sir.
Okay, we're that precise. It's not he's a drug seller. It's that we had these two controlled buys and he sold me this cocaine, which I'm handing you, right?
Yes. When that police officer showed my guy's picture to that confidential informant, he says, that's the dude that's doing all this.
We're way beyond that, right? All that it takes to revoke him is for the judge to have the evidence before him and believe it, that your client handed cocaine to the CI twice, right? That's enough.
But the court has to ensure that the evidence that he's relying upon to make that decision, or that perhaps my client was afforded his constitutional right to test that evidence.
But I want to get precise. I don't want this broad-ranging hearsay everywhere.
Okay.
What I want is, because I think this is right, maybe you'll agree, maybe you'll disagree, it would be enough to revoke him if the officer had come in and said, I had my binoculars on him and I saw the whole thing and we have a tape recording of it and so forth. You'd be good with that, right?
If they came in with that, Judge, I'd have a much harder time making this argument.
Well, you couldn't make an argument, could you? That would be a revocation.
I always make an argument,
okay.
Judge.
All right, so you're not a potted plant.
I was that big, I guess.
But what we do have is the officer testifies and he says, after the phone call was made, Mr. Murphy went to this address and came and met the informant, and the controlled buy was done right after he left the house on Norfolk. Cocaine was bought. It was tested. Again, it was presumptive positive. That all but says that the officer saw what happened. Why isn't it up to you to object? In other words, with that evidence, with their having trailed him, with her having put a tracker on his car and seen 40-some visits to Norfolk, this stash house in 12 days, and the other evidence, they know who it is. They've run his license plate. It's him. Why isn't that enough?
I can only say this, Judge, and after this I'd like to reserve my time. I can only say this, that
I'm going to give you 2 minutes, but that doesn't license for you to talk forever.
Yes, sir. The linchpin ultimately was the identification. And so I understand all of what the officers had surveilled.
They identified him. They knew who it was who drove up, and they knew where he'd been to the stash house.
They knew that there was a car they associated with Mr. Murphy, and they knew that they associated that house with Mr. Murphy. And the problem, though, and there was no testimony that I can recall. The government might correct me, but there was no evidence that the officers. I sat there and I watched that confidential informant get into the car with Marco Murphy, who I knew to be Marco Murphy. The officers never identified it. So my argument has to do with, if we're going to assume it's Mr. Murphy, Judge, then we need to make sure that you have valid, reliable evidence in which to make that decision.
Did you make that argument? Did you say, hey, Judge, at the end? I might have objected on personal knowledge, but I didn't, but still I want the benefit.
I had some foundation arguments, but that would have been the best way to pursue it, sir.
Counsel, there's a sentence in your brief that says this: Mr. Murphy arrived at the buy location in a silver Dodge Charger that was registered in his name. Do you stand by that statement?
Well, I believe that that was what the evidence in the light most favorable to the government would have shown.
Okay.
By virtue of my partner putting that in there, Judge, that doesn't mean I'm admitting today that that was my client selling that dope.
No, I understand that, but it does say he went to the buy location in the car that was registered to his name. Do we have that established?
I can't agree with that.
I'm from Colorado, and I'm telling you, you got to get your terms right. Cocaine isn't dope.
Judge, I've been representing folks for 25 years. It's a lot easier just to call it dope. Thank you. I'll be back.
So weed is dope. Did you guys get that? Weed is dope. All right. No, weed is not dope under that definition.
May it please the court. Richard Chella on behalf of the United States.
Let me just ask you right off the bat, why isn't that your argument? There was plenty of evidence here that he had violated his federal, state, or local law by A, using, which comes up in the transcript, and I used the thumbnail of banana, as he says on the phone, and the other jail calls about whose dope it was at Norfolk. Why are we doing all of this hearsay exercise? And isn't the question whether or not there's sufficient evidence apart from the hearsay? Let's just get all of that out of there and say, is there sufficient evidence for the government to revoke?
To that question, yes, Your Honor.
Well, why isn't that your brief then? Because that's not your brief.
Because as I understood the way the issue was framed for the court, Your Honor, the question was whether the district court had abused its discretion in admitting the hearsay testimony under rule.
Why did we get there? Why can't you just cut that off and say, nice argument, we appreciate the issue, but guess what? We don't even need to get there.
Used to be called the residual evidence rule, that there was enough residual evidence free of any potential hearsay taint.
I think that's certainly, to the extent that that wasn't briefed, I don't think that forecloses the court finding that we could prevail on those grounds. To your question, Your Honor, our arguments address the arguments raised by the appellant. And the first argument was that the issue presented to the court was whether the district court had abused its discretion in application of Rule 32.1.
Yeah, but we're asking you to assume it did. Take that evidence off the table and tell us why the remaining evidence would still support revocation.
I think there's...
you'd get there anyway under either a harmless error or a plain error prong three. So it's in the case. Why does the remaining evidence show that there should have been a revocation? I'm just repeating Judge Phillips' question, but go ahead.
I think there's ample evidence, Your Honor, that notwithstanding the hearsay issue altogether, that would support revocation. I would direct the court's attention to the GPS tracker device that was deployed on Mr. Murphy's car, which showed, as the court alluded to, during a period of 12 days, 45 visits to the stash house location at Norfolk. I would direct the court to the circumstances of Mr. Murphy's arrest, where on his person he had a key to that stash house. I would further point out
Is that in the transcript, that he had a key at the arrest?
That he had a key, Your Honor, not that the key itself had access to the Norfolk residence. The fact that the key had access to the Norfolk residence is in the record, but not the transcript.
Okay, when you say the record, what are you talking about? Because what is there in the record besides the revocation transcript?
In addition to the revocation transcript and the sentencing transcript, the record includes the police reports that were attached to the petition to revoke that was submitted to the court.
That was a petition for a search warrant. That was going to be another question. I mean, you reference it in your brief as the petition to revoke, but that's a petition for the search warrant.
The court of revocation finds that, had access to that resident at 1043, which is the Norfolk address. He had a key to that residence that subsequently searched contained a substance testing presumptive positive as cocaine.
That's correct, Your Honor, and that's because And I direct the court to volume 1, page 31 of the record. That is the petition for warrant for offender under supervision, which spells out the violation, which was here a new violation of state or federal law. And that petition includes therein the police reports.
Well, you didn't answer my question. Is that really part of the record? That isn't part of the petition for revocation. That's the petition for the warrant.
I believe, Your Honor, that we're... it's a semantics issue. This is the petition that provided the basis for the court to revoke. This is the document, that, again, referring to the petition for warrant under supervision that the court considered as to whether that the court had before it as to whether a violation had occurred. And the accompanying attachments to the petition...
Well, maybe I'm just not understanding how this is supposed to work. Why doesn't it say petition for revocation?
Frankly, Your Honor, I do not understand why that specific terminology is used, but I can tell Your Honor that the petition is used interchangeably, and there's no separate petition for revocation. This would be the petition revocation.
It's your argument that the court could properly consider those materials in deciding whether to revoke.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think the court could properly consider the attachments to the petition, and I think the court did properly consider those attachments. And one of them, specifically, if directing the court to volume 1, page 40, sets out the fact that after his arrest, Mr. Murphy had on him keys, and that was testified to that he had keys on him during his arrest. But the report further says...
Was the stash house some form of community center, or is he in command and control of the stash house?
The record indicates that Mr. Murphy had access to the residence. There was paperwork... and documents at the stash house belonging to another individual, not Mr. Murphy. So the record does suggest other people had access to that residence. But I would contend the fact that Mr. Murphy had a key to the residence, coupled with what the tracker showed, which was multiple visits, short-term visits, but multiple visits over a short window of time to that residence.
Do you contend that those visits are a revocation or a reason to revoke? Are you limited to the sale?
Your Honor, I would contend that those visits, paired with the other evidence that was presented by the petition and by the revocation hearing, is ample evidence. I would not argue here today that those visits alone would be adequate basis to revoke. But the visits, as indicated by the tracker, the possession of the key to the residence, and then the search of the residence.
Well, didn't the probation have these normal stuff that you shall not frequent places where there are drugs, for example?
Yes, Your Honor.
Wouldn't that be enough if he's making 45 visits to the stash house? I take it that wouldn't be for refreshments. End of case, right?
I think, Your Honor, that could be an adequate basis to revoke. That wasn't what the court identified in
the finding. Court identified, or you all charged? The court's limited to what you charge, isn't it?
I think that's a fair assessment, Your Honor. To be fair, it's the probation office that charges the underlying violation based on the conditions and whether there was a violation. And here, the violation set forth at Volume 1, page 31, is a violation of the mandatory condition not to violate state or federal law.
Is there only one hearsay statement that matters? And that is, these controlled buys are set up and they're not done well. I hope you see that, right? I mean, there's no video, there's no audio. The officers don't say we were watching with binoculars. There's all these open questions that you don't usually see with a controlled buy. But they do give the CI money. The money, they monitor and see that Mr. Murphy is coming in the car. They know is his because they've run the plates, had the tracker on him. They know a whole lot of information that's not hearsay. And off he goes with the money. Back he comes with the cocaine. And he says, Mr. Murphy gave me the cocaine. Is that the only hearsay comment that matters? All of the previous stuff, how they came to know Mr. Murphy, that's not even hearsay, is it? It's just background information for why they happened to be there that day.
I think that's, to your most recent question, Your Honor, I think that's a fair assessment it's difficult to parse because of the absence of an objection which specific hearsay is alleged hearsay is that issue. But I would agree with Your Honor that much of the testimony was not hearsay.
Okay,
not
well, we know the big one, which is he sold me cocaine. Murphy sold me cocaine. And we have this kind of vague testimony. Nobody ever asked, did you see it? Or how do you know that? The officer during the revocation hearing, maybe it's enough. Is it enough without the officer saying, I saw it, or what the officer's basis of knowledge was?
I want to confirm I understand your question, Your Honor. Are you asking, is it enough to support revocation? Or I think there's more than ample evidence if you removed even the informant's statement that you're alluding to, that it was Mr. Murphy who sold the cocaine. I think excising that statement from the record, I still think there's adequate evidence here to support the revocation decision. The facts I already laid out with respect to the tracker and the stash house among them, but also the search of the stash house of which this officer who testified was involved.
Where did the sale occur? Was it inside of a car?
That's not clearly set forth in the record, Your Honor, but I think in part because of the confidential nature of the informant, but that is, Your Honor, admittedly not set forth clearly in the
well,
record.
Well, if you're saying that Murphy would know who the CI was if you said that the CI had gotten into the car, I think that's a real stretch. I think Murphy probably does know who the CI was. He sold to him twice and whatever. But be so easy to just give us the information so we're not here sitting here struggling with this by nailing some things down at the hearing. And instead, we have a box of nails and no hammer, it seems like.
I can appreciate the court's concern, and I recognize the record could be more fully developed.
Can I just ask you to clarify something in your brief? Page 32, it says, officers observed Murphy selling crack cocaine on two occasions. What's the record support for making that statement?
The record support, Your Honor, is from the underlying police reports that I referenced that were included as attachments to the petition. And those reports indicate that there were officers surveilling Mr. Murphy, and that when he received a call from the informant, he traveled to the location, particularly of the second controlled buy.
Well, this is a pretty specific statement. That's why I'm wondering. Officers observed Murphy selling crack cocaine on two occasions. And that sounds like a revocable offense if that's really what happened. But I need some help. So you're relying on the police reports, not something that Officer Leatherman said at the hearing.
That's correct, Your Honor. There was no testimony at the hearing.
The police report's hearsay, too? That hearsay?
I think if properly objected to, some of the content of the police reports would qualify as hearsay, Your Honor.
Were they offered in evidence?
They were not. They were already before the court, Your Honor. They were not admitted as exhibits in the context of the hearing.
Was there any charging document?
That again, Your Honor, to revisit our discussion of the petition, that in this setting, the operative charging instrument is the what's the document at volume 1?
The document that doesn't say it's a charging document.
That's correct. On its face, it is unclear, Your Honor. I'll agree. It's labeled a petition for a warrant.
All right. I don't want to belabor the point. I was confused by that because I was wondering what happened to the document that says petition for revocation. There's nothing there that says that.
What does it allege? What is the violation?
The violation, Your Honor, is of a mandatory condition of the defendant's supervised release, and it alleges violation of mandatory condition. Now I'm quoting, the defendant shall not commit another federal, state, or local crime. And then it provides a narrative under the identified violation. Again, this is volume 1, page 31 of a summary.
So it never says by selling cocaine.
Well, Your Honor, the narrative below the actual listed violation does say that on April 2nd, 2018, Murphy was arrested by the Tulsa Police Department for the offense of trafficking cocaine and possession of firearm after conviction of felony. It further specifies that Tulsa Police Officer Tim Wilson would testify that in March 2018, Tulsa Police Department conducted surveillance on Murphy after receiving information from a confidential source that Murphy was selling cocaine. On April 2nd, 2018, a search warrant was executed at the residence where Murphy was witnessed selling cocaine during a controlled transaction. Officers were able to retrieve evidence to support the criminal activity was occurring at said residence. So okay. To your question,
sounds vague.
I would agree, Your Honor.
Would you agree that Officer Levin, at the revocation hearing, failed to provide the court with good cause not to call the CI or the non-testifying officers?
With respect to the CI, Your Honor, I don't think the testimony was from Mr. Officer Leatherman, but the United States, we did
it. Up if you'd the government answering the question.
The government, yeah. As to the informant, the good cause was established by the government's objection. Further, this court in Cruz recognized that.
But there was no explanation given for why the CI wasn't called. There might be all kinds of good reasons not to call the CI, but I didn't see anything that explained why. He's working other cases. It put him in danger if we brought him in. Nothing. And that was true of the officers, too. And there's no attempt to justify not bringing these witnesses in.
I think that's because, Your Honor, that the issue was not presented to the court. The right to confrontation was never asserted. The objection wasn't raised and brought to the court's attention, which would have necessitated some showing by the government to support the good cause component.
Well, I know your time's up, but I understand your argument.
All right. Great. Thank you.
Counsel, you had, I think I said I'd give you a couple of minutes, so I'll stick to my word.
Thank you, Judge. I appreciate that. The court had had some questions about what other offense conduct that was alleged might have been the basis for Judge Frizzell's revocation. And so I'm referencing at the record, Volume 2, Document 173, page 44 through 45, which was the revocation hearing.
Right.
Judge Frizzell said that found by a preponderance of the evidence that Mr. Murphy did commit another federal, state, or crime, that Mr. Murphy was involved in two controlled buys of cocaine. Now, he goes on to say that he's not going to hold that my client was responsible for the bulk of cocaine at the trap house that we've talked about. He does say that he believes that he did have access to that house. But ultimately, I would argue to the court that the decision was made upon those two controlled buys, which were only witnessed by and only proven by a confidential informant that I never had the opportunity to, I never asserted, but also never did have the opportunity to cross-examine. So,
Counsel, do you agree that the police reports are part of the record for our review?
Well, the government didn't move. It's like Judge Marion Apollo used to say at the Supreme Court of Oklahoma. He would say that filings are simply just pieces of tissue paper. Anybody can file anything. It's only when it comes into evidence before the court and been admitted that it actually is worthy of coming before this court. Just like my lack of objection, it's got to be admitted for this court to be able to review it. So I appreciate the gentleman.
So the answer is no?
I don't think it is, sir. I really don't. Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate your time.
Thank you. Case is understood and submitted. Counsel are excused. And we'll turn to the last case this morning before we turn to questions from students. And the next case is United States versus Arterbury. Case 18-5085.